The Lord be with you. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to be interacting with that part of the Hebrew bookshelf, in between the history and the stories and the poetry and the prophecy and the law, a little something that's come to be called the wisdom tradition. This is ancient, it's poetic, it's mysterious, and it's made up of a lot of practical instructions, often for young people. But generations of sages and thinkers and thoughtful people help put this stuff together. They talk about the practices we keep, the habits we form. Wisdom is close attention, hard-earned understanding, understanding of what it takes to make our very best attempt at a life well-lived. Wisdom is about what we do in a world full of troubles, full of pitfalls, full of dangers, and so many enemies even. It's what we do with this life we've been given. And wisdom knows what's at stake. This morning we heard from the Proverbs that waywardness kills the simple and complacency of fools destroys them. In no particular order, the wisdom books include the book of Job. We'll have a brief series on that in the next month. About 20 or so Psalms, including Psalm 1, which we looked at this summer. Of course, the book of Proverbs, the book of Ecclesiastes, and depending on who's counting, and I think you can count me in on this, the book of Song of Solomon, just to keep us on our toes. So from our awkward first squawking breath to our final resting place in the earth, the wisdom books speak to that whole untidy, glorious adventure in between we call life. And the wisdom books shine light on the corners of our lives that require attention, the day-to-day stuff that we might neglect or obsess over, the foolishness that arrives in our lives in so many forms. And the sages had every hope that we would avoid the worst sort of mistakes, the sort of mistakes we hope our teenage sons and daughters won't make, mistakes that we hope our grown-up moms and dads won't make, mistakes that can cost us so much. So what a treat it is, then, to find such a book in our Second Testament. It's a short little number called James. It's like a book of Proverbs for the church. This is wisdom for gospel people. James is a book of pastoral care and instruction, and it speaks to the places in our church families that require care and attention. James names the ways that church life can be toxic. James calls us out when we form little cliques. He calls us out when we play politics. He exposes those of us who would puff themselves up and posture. And he questions any substance of our faith that doesn't display real life action. He talks about money. He talks about the way we treat people. I think it's safe to say that there is something in James to make almost anybody squirm or blush or feel uncomfortable. But these are words we need to hear, because the church is so full of possibility, but it is also full of people. Just hang around the church long enough, and you will see the ways we act out, the ways we misbehave, the ways we hurt ourselves, the ways we hurt each other. The church is a gathering of flawed human beings, and we don't leave our hang-ups at the door. We bring them right on in with us, and we make them a part of this place. And always, in every church, there is a very real danger that the gathering of saints intended for healing and for life and for generosity might become a place of injury, destruction, and self-interest. Now, the funny thing, despite all of this, and as common sense as all this wisdom clearly is, there is a great temptation in church communities to paper over every trouble with religious language. A sort of nostalgic, churchy sentimentality. It's a sing-song kumbaya solution to what are real, gritty, and difficult problems. And James will have none of this. He's like the plumber who comes and tells you that there's a clog in the pipes and 3 feet of sewage in the basement and no amount of Febreze sprayed in the living room will amount to a solution. Drawing no doubt on much personal experience, James speaks with unflinching clarity about those realities which so easily divide and destroy us. And in chapter 3, James gets pretty real. In 12 verses, he stacks 8 or 9 metaphors to drive home his point. And his point is this: our words are powerful. Our speech, the things we say, can have catastrophic and far-reaching consequences. Our tongues are aflame. Wild, unbridled words are untamable. And they can tear people apart. Our words are dangerous. And whoever wrote that sticks and stones can break my bones verse didn't have a clue. Now, they say at this point of the sermon, I'm supposed to tell you maybe some sort of funny story or poignant moment from my own life, something that can make it real for us. You know, the story about that time Jeremy said something terrible or thoughtless or stupid that then exploded like a bomb in someone else's life. Or maybe that time I shared something that should have remained private. Or maybe I blurted out something thoughtless or mean even. But you know what? I don't think I can. Nadia Boltz-Weber says that preachers should preach from their scars, and they shouldn't preach from their wounds. Let me say that again. Preachers should preach from their scars, that is something they've healed from, and not their wounds, those things that keep on bleeding and festering. And if I'm honest, that a lot of these stories, even if they're 20 years old, still feel pretty raw. So today I won't be sharing, thank you very much. And really, I don't think I need to, because even right now, maybe you're bringing to mind a few stories of your own, scars and wounds both. Terrible, awful words that left your lips and took on a life of their own out in the world. Or maybe you're thinking of that toxic speech, those words that landed in your heart and found a piece of your soul to nest in. Those words still fester today. Or maybe it's not something you said. Maybe it's something you know you really needed to say. Words that someone else really needed to hear. But words that you keep to yourself. And it has the same horrible effect. Now, I think there's a reason. I think we can feel it in this room right now. There's a reason why you can't find any hymns about James 3, as much as Evelyn tried and tried and tried. Our often troubled speech life is a part of the church, and we know it is there. It's a running joke that church people gossip and fight and bite at each other. But we really don't want to talk about it, much less sing about it. That would be quite a hymn. Maybe we could write that hymn together, Evelyn. That would be a treat. We'll sing that next time James comes up in the lectionary. So what is James doing? Why is he doing this to us? He makes it sound so inevitable. Is he just rubbing our faces in our own mess like a spoiled puppy? And he seems so matter-of-fact about it when he says, "For all of us make many mistakes." Thank you for the great insight, James. Even as he unloads with a huge litany of poetic devices that highlight the consequences, the runaway dangers of our failings. Is this inevitable? If our tongues are so wild and dangerous and untamable, then really, what is the point? Well, I would say for a start, this is wisdom language. The sages wanted us to know that what we do as a church happens amidst all of those troubles, all of those pitfalls, all of those dangers, all of those big mouths, all of those gossips, all of those careless words. That's where the church happens. And James says, no, you will not get it right every time. But with attention and with care, and by the mercies of God, you can grow in wisdom. We can give attention to our speech lives, but we need to name these things because they are always with us. And ignoring realities like this is never a solution. This is awkward work that James is doing. But he is like a trailblazer in the forest, marking the path in the woods ahead of us, pounding in little hazard signs where the trail falls away. This is not futile. And yes, we will continue to make mistakes over and over again. But with attention and together, we can shape our common life. And we can name these things. And as we name these things, we actually grow in freedom. Because it's only when we start to name these things that we have the freedom to start talking about all those other hang-ups and struggles and problems that brought us here in the first place. People always ask me, how do you spend so much time with teenagers? And how do you take them on long trips on buses and trains and planes and heat? And I don't know. It seems to work out pretty good every time. I don't have any problem. I like those kids. It's pretty good. But I will say this much. At the beginning of every trip, they always get a little speech, and it goes something like this. In the days ahead, we will all take turns being the grumpy person, being the emotionally vulnerable person, being the excited person, the tired person, and the annoying person. Just not all on the same day. So let us remember to be gentle with each other. Give each other some space now and then. And, most importantly, let's have some hard conversations when we need to. Often with apologies. And then we go on our trip, and we give it our best shot, and we make many mistakes. And I can assure you that those trips are blessed times. I wouldn't trade them for anything. Now, I don't think anything that I've just said is especially groundbreaking, but I do think that it is the start of what it looks like to live together as a people, people who care for each other and account for their part in the whole mess of the whole thing. I think it's where we start as a church when we want to start caring for our words, the words we say that set fires all around us, and the words we hear that wound us so deeply. As I was writing this, I was thinking of that classic confession from the Book of Common Prayer. It goes like this. Most merciful God, we confess that we have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone. We have not loved you with our whole heart, and we have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We might add, by what we have said and by what we have left unsaid. The interesting thing is that the default position on a Sunday morning when we gather together to worship is that we recognize that the preceding 6 days have been peppered with missteps, mistakes, poorly chosen words, thoughtlessness, and even some outright meanness. It is one of the ironies and one of the miracles of the church. And even as James says it, I don't know if he knew what he was saying. From the same mouths come blessing and cursing. We are at once sinners and saints. Taming our tongues looks like an ongoing thing. And it's regularly interrupted by confessions and apologies. So friends, may we learn to guard our words and tame our tongues amidst our many mistakes. May we learn what it is to grow in wisdom as we learn to care for one another. May we be a people that give attention and care as we build and shape our common life in Christ Jesus. Amen.